Hello, my name's Paul Greatrix, and this edition of the University Registrar's Talking About Stuff podcast features, for the first time, two non-registrars, of course, which I am now one of. The foremost of the pair, though, is Olivia Q. Ficus, Chief Data Officer at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. We begin by learning about Olivia's highly valued and extremely transferable history degree and her early career working on supporting community partnership activity between the US and Ukraine. Following that, though, she decided a move into UK higher ed would be interesting and so took on a series of roles at the University of Birmingham before becoming assistant registrar with a job supporting senior leaders and generally doing interesting things with the vice-chancellor and the registrar. Following that, it was a short step to strategic planning and a new responsibility for a data team, which led her in all sorts of new and interesting directions. After 6 years as Director of Strategic Planning, Olivia returned to the US for a different kind of planning role, and then after a couple of years became Chief Data Officer at Vanderbilt. Apart from learning a slightly different higher ed vocabulary, she's worked hard to bridge across the technical data issues and the strategic level matters. Whilst there are many similarities between the US and UK in this area, the former has a much more diverse sector, as well as different senior leadership structures. Rankings are a big issue for Olivia and her university at present. Whilst Vanderbilt does well in domestic rankings, there is real concern about the dubious nature of the methodologies used and the sketchiness of sector data employed. Vanderbilt commissioned a study by a Chicago research unit, NORC, into the issues with ranking methods. Olivia and colleagues are therefore working with other universities to develop a new approach, separate to the rankings, to provide prospective students with the personalised information they need to inform their HE decision making. I'm sure we'll all be interested to see how this project pans out. Finally, Olivia reminds us that universities can be seen very much as small towns, with everything that entails, but they also have challenges that few can anticipate. It's a really interesting conversation, and I do hope you enjoy it. Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff. And this time we've got two non-registrars on the call. Me, I'm no longer a registrar, Paul Greatrix. I used to be a registrar, but I no longer am. And Olivia Q. Ficus, who is Chief Data Officer at Vanderbilt University in the US in Nashville, Tennessee, for those of you who've got good geographical knowledge. So welcome, Olivia. It's great to have a transatlantic podcast recording.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to talk to you again after so many years.
That's right, because we have worked together in the past, and we'll come on to that in just a second, because I do want to kind of review your career trajectory, which has seen you cross the Atlantic a couple of times at least. And then we know that you've been doing some fascinating work at Vanderbilt on league tables as well. So we'll talk a bit about that as well, no doubt, as a few other entertaining things about higher education along the way. But let's start with your first degree then. Do you want to tell us about, because you did a history degree initially, I think.
Yeah, so my undergraduate degree is in history from Princeton University. And if you had told me when I graduated 30 years ago from Princeton that I would be the chief data officer anywhere, I would have laughed in your face. So what I will tell you is that is the value of the liberal arts education, is that you can pivot to all sorts of things. But at that time, I was very interested. I was actually focusing on Ukrainian history. I was very interested in international work and engaging internationally, possibly doing a PhD in Ukrainian history. That's my kind of alternate trajectory in a different quantum universe, you know. And I got a job working in international development. I had spent some time in Ukraine. I speak Ukrainian and Russian, and I spent 3 years working in international development in Ukraine, and then I pivoted into working in international programs in a university setting. Spent a few years in California, but my parents are British, and so I always had this connection to the UK. And started kind of applying to things in the UK in the international development sphere, because the UK obviously has been very advanced over the years in international development. and got a job at the University of Birmingham, working in the International Development Department, doing projects development, and really kind of didn't look back. That was in 2003. Came to Birmingham, found that it was an institution with just a lot of opportunities for me. I moved into research management. I was the school manager in the School of Education for a year. And then shortly after David Eastwood became the vice chancellor at Birmingham, he was looking to increase his capability to do interesting things. Posted the and he and Lee Sanders, the registrar there, posted a job of what was being called assistant registrar. And it was
Classic
basically
old terminology, yeah.
kind of do interesting stuff for the vice chancellor and the registrar. And I read the job description and I'm like, that's me. They want me. And I applied for it and I got the job and did that for several years, working really closely with the senior leadership. And then when the position of director of strategic planning came open at Birmingham, I applied for that and moved into that. And as I say to people, it came with a data unit, you know, it came with a BI unit. And I really wasn't quite sure what to do with that for probably a couple of years. And it's like, this is interesting. And the data piece just became a bigger and bigger with GDPR, with HESA data
Yeah.
futures, with all of those things. The data piece just became a bigger and bigger part of my job. And I really enjoyed it. And so when I got to the end of it was 2018, was thinking kind of, okay, I've been doing that job now for about 7 years. Okay, what's the next step? My parents had remained in the US. They were based just outside Nashville, and this position came open at Vanderbilt. And it was actually as executive director of institutional research. And I tell people at Vanderbilt, and they kind of look at me askance. I just sent a cold email to the provost at Vanderbilt, and I said, "This is who I am. Do you think this might be of interest?" And she wrote me back and said, "Stay in touch." And long story short, I applied for the job. I got the job, and I said to them during my first days there, I said, "What do you really want from this job?" Because we can talk a little bit about institutional research and what that is and so on. And they said, "We want somebody to make our data strategic, Olivia." And I thought, well, I can do that, you know, strategic planning, data, having worked at that point over a decade kind of with senior people in at the University of Birmingham. It's like, yeah, I know how to do that. And so that's really what I've been doing for the past 5.5 years.
Fantastic. And so the So in a sense, you've kind of grown into the data sphere, as it were, but you've absorbed it enthusiastically rather than skeptically, as it were. And but I mean, going back to your first point was, how do you find it coming from that, quite generalist arts humanities background to being immersed in the numbers all the time? Has it been a, you know, Has it been an easier journey, or have you felt that you've had to do it, in a sense, do it all yourself because you weren't equipped to do it?
So, history is a great discipline anyway, because history can be all sorts of things. It's a fairly omnivorous discipline, and so historians don't tend to just have one way they approach things. So I think that helped me. The other thing I think helped me was actually that I spent a lot of time studying languages, and so I'm working cross-culturally. So I'm used to having to pick up concepts in one way and move them over in another way. And what is true about data is that it is to really make data sing, you need to understand the full life cycle. And you need to be interacting with technical people, and you need to be interacting with people who you know barely know the front end of a computer. And you have to be able to kind of handle that whole range. And so I do an awful lot of translation. I do a lot of making sure I understand the concepts. So I really focus on what does it mean. I rely on people who know more about the technical detail than I do, and I have a group of people around me who do that. I know
Yeah.
how to converse with them and get the information that I want out of them. And I really focus on how do we figure out what matters and how do we make it make sense. And that I think is the piece that's often missing. A lot of data people have come out of a technical background, and so they can do the technical bit much better than I ever could. But what they can't do is the what does it mean? What does a provost need to know today?
No, I completely agree, and I think you mark yourself out there as a pretty rare breed of people who are able to make that, that step across those two very different domains, and also, and translate between one and the other, but also bridge them, because I think it is easy to, lots of people in one domain or the other, but very, very difficult to join the two up in a meaningful way. And I think you've got to be a, distinctive kind of, so I'm not flattering you here, Olivia. I think you've got to have something distinctive to be able to pull those two things together in a way that makes sense to both. And I think your point about, kind of your language facility has, made me think that actually, that I can absolutely see your observation there as being a pertinent one. And yeah, it's fantastic you could do it, and absolutely fascinating, because I think there are very few people in your position who are able to make that, journey across the domains.
What I will say, you asked me whether it would have been difficult. So the learning the technical aspects is my biggest challenge. And I do, you cannot be a CDO without having a lot of technical facility. You have to be able to go and talk to people about really quite crunchy stuff. And there was a point about 3 years ago when I suddenly looked down at myself and I'm like, Olivia, you've become a tech executive. How did that happen? But the great thing was it suddenly opened up to me a whole different vista of networking. So I network on the higher education side in the US, but I also have an entire network, which is just the technology network. And so I go to the Gartner conference, and I've actually been shortlisted by the Nashville Technology Council as CDO of the year. And then and I was going to show you, I got a little baby guitar for being shortlisted.
Fantastic.
And
Fantastic.
so that's been just so exciting. It's so much fun to just be talking to people who have nothing to do with higher education and to have enough common language, and then to say, okay, what can I grab from that and bring back into the university setting?
But that exactly that, and I think that's the kind of thing that adds huge value to your institution as well, I'm sure. But having that higher education knowledge and being able to work out what matters and what doesn't in that context, I think is really important. And I'm just going back then to your Birmingham experience. I mean, the question for me in my mind about the, your kind of role in strategy there in that environment. I mean, how different was the UK higher education environment to the US? I mean, did it feel like, conceptually, chalk and cheese? I mean, how big was that particular leap?
So, I mean, it helps that I came out of the US already. So it wasn't like, and actually I call myself a higher education rat. I went to high school in a town that was dominated by a small liberal arts college. My peers were the children of the faculty. So my mother worked at a large state university for 20 years. So I know higher education, right? And at this point, I've probably only spent like 5 years outside of it since I became an adult. But I do, what really struck me coming to Vanderbilt was that was actually the commonalities. A large research university, at least in an English-speaking country, turns out to be a large research university. And what I found was that I had all the right boxes in my head, and I had to just shuffle them up. Which actually would be true between universities in the UK as well. Not everything is kind of put in the same pillars. And then I had to make one more conceptual leap, which was to change my language around a lot of things. So the one people know, of course, is academic staff becomes faculty, right? I think everybody's kind of fairly comfortable with that. Estates becomes facilities. If you say estates, they have no idea what you mean. And then the one that totally floored me was they were talking about IRB. And I'm sitting there going, what the heck is IRB? And they all talk about it like they should know. It's a research ethics board. But they're all called IRB because the federal government required that everybody create an IRB. And so as far as, and so there was, it was learning the new language, but the pieces were pretty much all there.
Oh, that really is fascinating. Because one of the things that I think we engaged with each other on when you were at Birmingham was there was a kind of move developing towards going to a GPA grade point average in the UK, because the traditional degree classification system, was widely regarded, it's still in the same position, as a bit broken on account of the fact that everyone gets a 2-1 or a first, basically. And therefore something finer grained, say a grade point average, would be the way to go. And obviously the US is the home of that, and it's commonplace around the West. I don't think anyone apart from the UK uses degree classifications. They are just so antiquated. But anyway, presumably that was something that was had to be relearned when you moved to the US.
There were certainly things, and there are differences. It's a much more diverse sector, and so there are entire categories of institutions that just don't exist in the UK. So Vanderbilt itself is in one of them. Private, large private research university is an unknown thing in the UK. Liberal arts colleges. My daughter is now a sophomore at a small liberal arts college in Washington State. That category does not exist in the UK. And then the kind of interplay between the different types of state institutions and community colleges and all of that is it's different. And then of course it's vaster. And there's all the different states are slightly different. And then you go to conferences. And I actually met some people from USISA at the EDUCAUSE conference a couple of years ago. EDUCAUSE is the equivalent of USISA. And they were just kind of going, it's so big. There was thousands and thousands of people there. And we were in McCormick Place, which is this huge, conference center on the shores of Lake Michigan. And so you kind of have to, you kind of have to. You, there are differences, and certainly the networking piece has been much more. It's taken longer because partly because of size.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, when you were first looking at Vanderbilt and talking to them, the role I think you were originally interested in was an institutional research role. And I think that's one of those areas that is actually in the UK is genuinely underdeveloped, right? In that whilst you may have one or two people working on things which would fall under that broad umbrella, right? There aren't huge, or even significant units within most UK universities that you would describe in the same way as genuinely institutional research. They might support strategy development, they might do data stuff, but actually, I think that, and tell me if I've got this wrong a little bit, but it seems to me that there is a much more developed sense of institutional research in US higher education. Is that fair?
I haven't found a massive difference between institutional research and planning in the UK. I accept that I think that the institutional researchers see themselves there is what I would say is the difference is there is a different standard of statistical rigor applied to most institutional research work. In the planning office in Birmingham, we had some great people. We did a lot of work, and they were a fabulous team, and I learned so much from them. When I came to Vanderbilt, I found that I had multiple statisticians on my team, and I didn't have any true statisticians at Birmingham. It was never a question. So we get asked a lot about is this statistically significant or not? So those are questions we grapple with regularly. So that's been a learning curve for me. I think that what is where the UK is possibly more advanced is that the institutional research in the US is just trying to integrate better into kind of the strategy of the institution. And there's been some push and pull on that. The Association of Institutional Research is really advocating for this and trying to build people's skills up in that area. But there's a little bit more, I think it tends to sit a little bit more at arm's length, whereas strategic planning and, you know, or whatever it's changed its name a number of times, has always been very plugged in and has increasingly been plugged into the idea of what's the institutional strategy. And so for me, that was a natural jump to say when they said make it strategic, I was like, okay, I know how to do that. Whereas I think a lot of institutional research directors who come up through that stack find that a harder jump to make.
On I mean you the point about statisticians is an interesting one, because one of the challenges I've often seen is the enthusiasm of institutional members, particularly faculty, to focus on arguing about the data and its sources and its validity rather than the big issues which are emerging from the data. It's much easier to have an argument about the statistical validity of the data than it is to accept that there is something there. Is that something that goes away when you've got a load of statisticians on the team? No.
No, that comes back. That comes back. That comes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. It really is about the data storytelling. And in the data circles now, there's a lot of conversation about data storytelling, both in higher education and not. And I think that, you know, it's about saying what really matters here. And my team has to have enough integrity that we don't allow ourselves to play the game of only providing the numbers that tell the story somebody wants to tell. But at the same time, we can't just dump everything on people and say, hey, you figure it out for yourselves. We have to say these are the things that are important. And so we spend a lot of time going through that and refining again and again from the kind of the bulk of the big data piece, whatever it is, survey results or whatever, to say what are the things we're going to focus on, we're going to take to the provost, we're going to take to the chancellor, we're going to talk about those things.
I mean, you've been there a few years now, and you clearly, done something to merit that profile, which has got you shortlisted as data officer, chief data officer of the year. What of all of the things that you've done then, what do you think is the thing that this is a really unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway, is the thing that you're most proud of that has made the biggest difference in terms of your contribution at that, top level to the success of the university, or contributing in some way to improving things or changing things at Vanderbilt? What's the thing that you think is the most significant?
So, I mean, I think it's a process rather than a thing, Paul, or as always. What we've done is we've been able to really change. We've implemented a data strategy. We're actually just implementing our, we're just starting to kick off our second iteration of that. And we have really been able to change where data sits. It's w there was always an interest when I first started at Vanderbilt. You know, I met with some of the folks during the recruitment round, and you know, they said we want more data, we want to get involved with it. So there was already an openness to it, but people had no idea how to even go about it. And we've been able to change that dynamic. So now people want to be part of the data process and are starting to be willing to invest in it and to think about it and to, you know, put their money where their mouth is. We, in terms of specific areas where I think we've moved the needle the most, we were always in the academic stack. So the institutional research office sat under the provost, who is the, so again, the language is different. Our chancellor is our president, and then there are 10 vice chancellors. Vice
Ten.
chancellor, 10 of them. The vice chancellor for academic affairs is the provost. And we were in the provost stack, and one of the things that I was able to make happen a couple of years into my time at Vanderbilt was for us to be moved from the provost's office to the chancellor's office, because that opened us up, us really working across all the vice chancellors. And The immediate uptake was from the Vice Chancellor for Development and Alumni Relations, DAR. And they were just implementing a Salesforce system, and they wanted to, and they had a new vice chancellor, and they wanted to figure out how they were going to do this differently. And so we were really able to get in there and work alongside them from the very, from the ground up with that data. And that has been just tremendously interesting. And it was total greenfield for me. I really had, we, I'd not worked with DAR and at Birmingham at all, except, to be friendly with them, I mean, and so it's been, and we can see how the work that we've done has improved the quality of that data, but has also led to actual dollars, actually, millions of dollars that have been raised in part because of the work we've done. And it's always a team effort. We haven't done all of it, but that's been very, very exciting because in universities, unlike in the corporate sector, we can't usually, we're not revenue flexible, are we? And so even in the US, we're not. Oh, fundraising is the one place we are, and we can say, yeah, we did this and it brought in this.
Great. Oh, that's really impressive, Olivia. The one other area that data impinges on, big issues in relation to university performance is in the domain of the international or indeed national rankings, right? And this is something that, you often hear people in your kind of position being beaten up for, it's somehow, seen as your fault that the data isn't telling the story that the university wants to have told about itself in the national and international league tables. I think this is something that you've been really focused on in at Vanderbilt in terms of the inadequacies which have been well reported around the sector of these things, but they are nevertheless there. They're pervasive, they're impactful, they trouble everyone within higher education, and yet they are they're all present. So what have you been doing in relation to these particular issues? Because I know it has been a concern for you.
It has been, and it's another, so league tables, rankings. League tables doesn't mean anything in the US, so
Right.
I've had
Okay,
to
it's only
switch my
rankings,
language to
right.
rankings. But I no, but I'm I will I will probably be bilingual as we talk about this. When I came to Vanderbilt, they had done a huge amount of work and had really focused on US News and World Report, which of course is the granddaddy of the of all the rankings, and was one of the first ones to kick off. And actually it had been Vanderbilt's move from being a kind of a top 25 to a top 15 had made a massive difference to Vanderbilt's reputation. So in the last 20 years, Vanderbilt moved from being what's called, a really good regional university in the US to being a university with a very much a national profile. So we compete directly with institutions like Princeton, Yale, Duke, Stanford for students. We're not a second, a has-been or anything like that. Second choice. We're very often right up there, and that's been tremendous for the institution. But they really hadn't thought at all about the international rankings. And so they had kind of ridden this wave of being better and better and having it reflected in the national rankings. And the international rankings, I said to them in my first week there, I said, what are you doing? You're not where you should be. And they said, oh yeah, you haven't really. And so we spent a lot of time talking about international rankings and spent some time focusing on that. But we also spent some time looking at the domestic rankings and saying, well, and I realized that the data that goes into those domestic rankings was much worse, actually, than the data that goes into the UK league tables. And so that is one of the things that in
Right.
general is true in the US, is there's much worse national data sources. There is no HESA. There is no, there is no There's iPEDS, but iPEDS is a it's what the federal government collects, but it's much less granularity than what there is in the UK. And there's no NSS. There's no graduate outcomes data collection. There's nothing like that that is comprehensive. Everything is bits and pieces, and different people do different surveys, and the federal government publishes something called College Scorecard, but it's only data on, and it tells you a little bit about outcomes, but it's only data on students who've received federal aid. And so it's all fragmented, and so this data was feeding into these various rankings. And there's not just U.S. News. There's this Wall Street Journal. There's Forbes has a ranking, and there's some that the Washington Monthly. There's some that publish regularly. There's some that publish less regularly. And it was being used in a way that really just felt like it was not robust. And so we started talking about it internally at Vanderbilt, and the more we talked about it, and there were some methodological changes that were made by US News, the more it became clear that these rankings were actually just providing a misleading view for undergraduate students. And so our chancellor commissioned this study by NORC, which is a social research company it's been affiliated with the University of Chicago. I think it's now an independent organization. And we worked with NORC over a number of months, and they did a very, very rigorous, academically informed study of the methodology of what goes on with rankings. And what they found was that kind of on every single level, there was not concept validity. What they were measuring was not clear. What does good mean? They never really seemed to define it, whether there was a clear sense of this is good or not. What the quality of the data was all over the place. There was a lot of subjectivity in decisions they made about methodology, like weightings and stuff. How did they decide that this weighting mattered? And then when they present it as a ranking, it makes it look like it's this objective, like, judgment, whereas there's massive uncertainty in what's going on there. And so that was really important for us, because we were saying, okay, so if these are providing just a misleading view for students, what would it take to give students the information that they really need? And so we're in the middle of a project right now, which is trying to ask that question. We're working with a number of other institutions and continuing to work with NORC. We're trying to reimagine what it would take so that students can get the information they need, that you can reflect that diversity of higher education in the US that I was talking about earlier. And that you can reflect that students themselves have very different needs. And so you can say, how do you personalize this? How do you use some of the new technologies we have now to personalize this so that it becomes, what do you need, Paul? Or what do you need, Olivia? Not like, what does some student who might get into Harvard need?
No, I think that's really fascinating, because all those things you say are failings of the rankings wherever you go. I mean, some of them might draw on more accurate and objective data in some domains. As you say, if you happen to have HESA doing a good job in the UK, that's great. But you're still loads of subjectivity all over the place in terms of the weightings, the choice about which indicators to actually use anyway. And as you say, many of those things, may actually not be valid at all. And when you get to a kind of global scale, it's just all over the shop. But I absolutely applaud your desire to do more from the point of view of the applicant, because the starting point for all these was, yes, we need to give people objective information to enable them to make informed decisions, right? And on the face of it, that's absolutely right. Of course, you want people to have the right information to make their judgments, but actually, it's someone else making the decision for them about that Harvard's better than Vanderbilt or Cal State or wherever it might be. So it's not right. But if you're able to provide all that information and let applicants, put it together in a way that makes sense for them, then they can make a better informed choice without someone else deciding what the weighting is or whether or not you should include part-time staff or, all that kind of stuff. And so I think it's a, it's a potentially a really valuable thing if you're able to get it going. So it isn't just Vanderbilt, you've got other people on board with it.
We have a consortium,
Great.
and so we're trying to move together, and we're trying to bring in experts like the institutional research community and so on in order to get feedback on how to make, because this is not going to be a small effort. This is going to be a lot of work, and we think the payout could be big. We equally, could find that it's not the first time somebody's tried to do this. We could find that it doesn't go as we plan. We'll see.
No, I know. I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, people have been in the position of moaning about this stuff before, right? And said, well, we must all pull out and then try and do other things. We had the example of the European Union, which tried its U multi-rank approach, which was very much following the same principles you've articulated. The international rankings are terrible. Let's try and create a ranking which isn't a ranking, which shows people things in a nice pie chart format, but makes it look all kind of non-comparative, but informative. And it cost a fortune, and I'm not certain it actually achieved very much. And well, I think it may well have died a death. I don't know, but there are ways of doing that, I think, which are work in the interest of the applicant wherever they're applying. And if you're able to use contemporary technologies to make that happen, that would be terrific. Of course, the vested interests in the big ranking community will hate you for it.
So they will. They might. I don't know. I do think the international rankings are a little bit different, and it because they're working with different data sets, and they frankly are they're answering a slightly different question. So we're very focused right now on how do you answer the question of how do you help that student figure out what's the right place for them. And that's not the question that actually the international rankings are generally trying to answer. I know that, they're starting to try and differentiate themselves and move in a different direction, but they're much more reputationally and research based. And so we haven't really grappled on the international side yet. And we continue to engage with several of those rankers, and we continue to engage as well in U.S. News and World Report. Some institutions have decided to not submit data or boycott them, and we've said no, we're not right now. We're not doing that. We're continuing to send them in information from Vanderbilt. So, we're trying to become part of that and another source, but a very credible source of information.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out, Olivia. I'll be watching with great interest from afar. So we're running out of time now, but the one final thing I just wanted to ask you is if there is anything in your long career in different institutions or studying in higher education which is a particularly interesting or amusing or perplexing or unusual thing that you would like to share.
So you gave me warning of this question, and I always think back. So whenever I interview people to come into a university setting, if they've come from outside higher education, I always find it interesting to engage with them and say, what do you think matters to us? And you almost invariably find that they think university, undergraduate education, and then they have a real difficulty kind of expanding their imagination as to what we do beyond the undergraduate education. And you engage in this conversation where you explain it to them in that interview a little bit more about what we do. And I often use the story of, we do everything. I think Lee Sanders used to say, we're like a small town. And we do almost everything a small town does, but we then do some things that small towns don't do. I was in this budget meeting with the College of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Birmingham, and we were talking about academic staff numbers and, all the normal things you talk about in budget meetings. And the provost says to the head of college, well, is there anything else you want to bring to the table? And he says, we need to talk about where the zebrafish are going to go. And it
The
turned
big
out
issue.
there was some building going on, and the facility where we had been raising zebrafish was going to be removed, and they had to figure out where to put them. And I love working in an environment where we have to worry about all the things any big organization has to worry about, but we also have to worry about where are we going to grow zebrafish.
It's a critical issue. They're remarkable animals, and obviously there's a huge amount of legislation to do with their protection as well that you have to be aware of. Well, that's absolutely terrific story, Olivia. Thank you. So we need to stop there, but listen, thank you so much for having the conversation. It's been really great talking to you and learning about your time in the UK as well as at Vanderbilt as well, and all about your campaigns around rankings in the US. So we look forward to hearing more about that in due course. And very best of luck with your Chief Data Officer of the Year shortlisting and award. When will you find out whether or not you've won?
So the awards ceremony is February 27th, and it is at the Country Music Hall of Fame. So
No.
if nothing
Wow.
else, it should be a spectacular evening.
Wow. Well, the very best of luck with that, but
Thank you very
congratulations
much.
on being shortlisted. It's been fantastic talking to you again after the, what has been a period of years, Olivia, but it's been great catching up. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, Paul. It's been a pleasure, and I hope that it won't be another 5 years before we talk again.
Yeah, me too. Thanks a lot. That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.